Leaving the hospital docking platform behind, Saint-Pestage accelerated into a mid-level traffic lane, then began to ascend toward the upper-tier thoroughfares until he had entered a rarefied zone of limousines and private sky cars. He piloted the car to the attached platform of a luxurious, kilometer-high skyscraper and docked. From the car's luggage compartment, he retrieved two expensive-looking bags. The larger was a rectangular handheld piece. The other was a sphere about the size of a sweet melon, which fits snugly into a specially designed shoulder bag. Pestage carried both into the building's upper-tier lobby. Few residents were about, and none gave him a second look, trusting implicitly that anyone who had managed to get into the building had every right to be there. He rode the turbo lift to the penthouse, which was owned by one of Palpatine's peers in the Senate, but was presently unoccupied, as the senator had, only the previous day, embarked on a visit to her homeworld. In the penthouse alcove, Pestage carried the bags to the entry and tapped a code into a touchpad mounted on the wall, which essentially commanded the scanner to cut short its usual security routine and simply open the suite. The bypass code did the job, and the door pocketed itself into the wall. Soft lighting came up as Pestage moved into the elegant front room. Furniture and artwork attesting to the senator's refined taste were everywhere in evidence. Pestage went directly to the terrace doors and stepped outside. From the chest-high wall at the edge of the terrace, Pestage could see clear to the Jedi Temple in one direction and the Galactic Senate in the other. But those weren't the views that interested him. Only the view directly across the cityscape canyon into a mostly darkened penthouse of similar size. Pestage set the two pieces of luggage on the floor and opened them. The square one contained a computer with a built-in display and keypad. The second was a surveillance droid, black and round, with three antennae projecting from its metallic pate and sides. Standing the computer on end, Pestage positioned the droid alongside it. The two devices conversed for a long moment in a dialogue of beeps and warbles. Then the surveillance droid levitated of its own accord and began to float out into the canyon. Pestage repositioned the computer so that he could monitor the flight of the surveillance droid while he entered commands on the keyboard. By then, the black sphere had crossed the abyss and was hovering just outside one of the penthouse's lighted rooms and relaying color images back to the computer's display screen. The small screen showed five Twi'lek females lounging together on comfortable furniture. One of the females was Senator Ornfree Ta's red-skinned Lethan consort, and they were all indulging in drink and gossip while the fat-faced senator was off visiting Valorum at the hospital. Pestage was pleased. The females were so absorbed in debauched merriment that they were unlikely to interfere with his business. He instructed the surveillance droid to move to an unlighted window, three rooms away, and go to infrared mode. A moment later, the screen displayed a close-up of Ta's computer terminal, which, while it was capable of interfacing with distant systems, could not be accessed remotely. Pestage did rapid input at the keyboard. Pressing close to the window, the droid activated a laser and burned a small hole in the window just large enough to accommodate the computer interface arm that telescoped from its spherical body. At the end of the arm's extensible rod was a magnetic lock, which the droid inserted into the access port of Ta's system. The computer booted up and asked for a passcode, which Pestage provided. A novice operative might have thought to ask Senator Palpatine how he had secured the passcode, but part of what made Pestage a true professional was knowing when not to ask questions. Ta's computer welcomed him inside. Now, it was simply a matter of slicing into the relevant files and planting the bits of coded information Pestage had been given. Even so, the infiltration was hardly routine. First of all, the data had to be untraceable, and it had to be implanted in such a way that the computer would be convinced that it had, in fact, discovered the data. Then the computer had to be instructed to reveal the data only in response to specific requests from Ta. Most important, Ta himself would have to be persuaded that he had uncovered data of such resounding consequence that he was compelled to shout it from the rooftops. At the center of the Jedi Temple's High Council spire was an enormous holographic representation of the galaxy, which highlighted trouble spots and locations of Jedi activity. Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan stood on the circular walkway that surrounded the holomap, waiting to be called before the members of the High Council. "This is the first time I've ever seen Coruscant singled out," Obi-Wan remarked as he gazed up at the sphere, his elbows resting on the walkway railing. Qui-Gon glanced at the flashing spheroid that was Coruscant, then allowed his eyes to roam midway to the holomap's perimeter, where a second spheroid was aglow. Dorvala. "Coruscant should remain illuminated at all times," he started to say, when yet another spheroid, at even greater remove than Dorvala, began to flash. "Eriadu," Obi-Wan said, reading the graphic attached to it. He looked questioningly at Qui-Gon. "The site of the upcoming trade summit." "Whose idea was that, Master?" Obi-Wan asked. Before Qui-Gon could respond, Adi Gallia entered the holomap room. "We're ready for you, Qui-Gon," she announced. Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan folded their arms so that each hand disappeared into the opposite sleeve of their cloaks and followed Gallia to the turbo lift that accessed the summit chamber. "Don't say anything, Padawan," Qui-Gon said gently when they reached the circular chamber. "Simply listen and learn." Obi-Wan nodded. "Yes, Master." Leaving Obi-Wan to wait by the turbo lift, Qui-Gon advanced to the center of the room and stood with his hands crossed in front of him. To the right of the turbo lift sat Depa Bilaba, a slender, near-human female from Chalakta, who wore a mark of illumination between and slightly above her eyes. Beside her was Eeth Koth, his face a jigsaw puzzle of lines, and his hairless head studded with vestigial yellow horns of varying length. Next came the long-necked Quermian, Yariel Poof. Then Adi Gallia, Oppo Ranchisis, and even Peel, a Lannic warrior whose face bore a puckered scar. To Peel's left sat Yaddle, a female of Yoda's species, Ceci Tien, and Iktachi, with downward-facing horns, Ki-Adi Mundi, a strikingly tall humanoid from Seria, Yoda in the red chair that cupped him, and Yoda's peer, Mace Windu, a powerfully built, dark-complexioned human with a shaved skull. To Windu's left, close to the opposite side of the turbolift entrance, sat Plo Koon. Fingers interlocked, Mace Windu leaned forward in his seat to address Qui-Gon. "We've just met with members of the Judicial Department regarding the attempted assassination of Supreme Chancellor Valorum. We're trusting that you can shed additional light on what transpired at the Galactic Senate." Qui-Gon nodded. "I trust that I can." Yoda glanced at Windu, then leveled his gaze at Qui-Gon. "How came you to be at the Senate, Qui-Gon? Alerted by your source in the Nebula Front, were you?"
"I'll answer that," Adi Gallia said. "I asked Qui-Gon to accompany me to the Senate, to speak personally with Supreme Chancellor Valorum."
Windu regarded her with a frown. "For what purpose?" Adi looked briefly to Qui-Gon.
"Qui-Gon has reason to believe that the Supreme Chancellor errs by relying on worlds along the Rima trade route to end terrorism in those sectors."
"Knows much about the situation, Qui-Gon does," Yoda said with false flattery. "Correct he was about Captain Cole surviving the explosion at Dorvala."
He paused.
"Behind the attempted assassination attempt is Cole?"
"No, Master," Qui-Gon said. "Cole is on the run. Furthermore, I'm not persuaded that the Nebula Front actually wished to harm the Supreme Chancellor." Yoda's expression hardened.
"Shot him, they did. Traced by documentation to their secret base in the Senex sector, they were."
"Too easily, Master," Qui-Gon said, holding his ground. "The signs were far too obvious. The assassins aimed their bolts at Supreme Chancellor Valorum's guards. I believe that the bolt that grazed him was inadvertent. The escape was also unconvincing. And since they must have known in advance that there was little chance of all of them getting away, why would they carry documentation?"
"Unlike Captain Cole, eh, Qui-Gon?"
Qui-Gon nodded. "He would not have been so careless." Yoda brought his right forefinger to his mouth.
Plan this he did, from afar. Seek out your Bith contact in the nebula front, you must.
Qui-Gon turned to him. I'll do that, Master. Still, why would the front target the Supreme Chancellor when he has finally taken a stand against the Trade Federation?
Answer your own question, Windu said.
Qui-Gon took a breath and gave his head a quick shake. I'm not certain, Masters, but I fear that the Nebula Front has something even more treacherous in mind. Typhons of angry light streaking past her to all sides, the Hawkbat fled the surface of a green planet, graced by two small, close-set and heavily cratered moons. Her ardent pursuers were a trio of slender-bodied vessels, Coruscant red from stem to stern, with multiple pairs of turbolaser batteries. In the gunship's cramped bridge, Boyne studied the console's authenticator displays.
Corellian space cruisers, Captain! Gaining fast!
Where are those jump coordinates, Rella? Cole snapped.
Coming up now, she assured him. It's time we put this sector behind us, Cole. Every one of our hideouts is under surveillance. I don't care if we go live with the Hutts. I just know it's gotten too hot for us here.
Cole grimaced. Don't tell me you'd work for those bloated worms.
Who said anything about working?
What about our retiring in high style?
Right about now, I'll settle for retiring, plain and simple.
Cole watched Rella for a long moment. You're serious, aren't you? You're thinking of quitting this tour. Rella bit her lip and nodded. He thought about it, then laughed. You won't walk. You know you'd miss me and come looking for me. Rella showed him a sad look. You're thinking of the old me, Cole. Cole shook his head. Our first fight.
Wrong, Cole. Our last.
She reached for the throttle,
making the jump to hyperspace.
In the greeting room of his office in the Galactic Senate, Valorum regarded his image in an elaborately framed mirror. His right arm was almost healed. Instead of the cumbersome Bacta tube, a soft case was in place, concealed within the ample sleeve of his overcloak. A pair of Senate guards flanked the door, facing into the room, but Valorum ignored them as he prepared for the imminent arrival of Jedi Masters Mace Windu and Yoda. Normally, the Jedi were not asked to intervene in trade disputes, but the attempt on Valorum's life had had less to do with trade than with preserving law and order. Because the Jedi answered to the Supreme Chancellor and the Judicial Department, their assistance could now be solicited, and in that sense, the assassination attempt had been a blessing in disguise. Valorum heard the guards snap to attention as the greeting room opened and Sae Terria entered, followed by the two Jedi Masters. Dignified in his hooded robe, linen-white tunic, and knee-high brown boots, Mace Windu seemed to fill the room. But it was the slight and enigmatic Yoda, in well-seasoned and less tailored robes, who took up the most space.
Masters Windu and Yoda, Valorum said warmly, thank you for coming.
Yoda regarded him for a moment, then smiled lightly.
Restored you are.
Valorum touched his right forearm beneath the cloak.
Nearly, if the assassin had been a better shot.
Windu and Yoda traded meaningful looks. How may the Jedi be of service, Supreme Chancellor? Windu asked. Valorum motioned to chairs in the sitting area.
Won't you be seated?
Windu sat. Yoda considered the offer, but then paced to the center of the room, tapping the floor with his cane.
Think better in motion, I do.
Valorum dismissed Sae Terria and the two guards, and sat down opposite Windu, where he could watch Yoda as well.
I trust you've heard that the assassins have been identified as members of the Nebula Front.
Valorum waited for Windu's nod before continuing. The few that managed to escape were traced to Osmaru, a world on the edge of the Senex sector.
I have communicated with the rulers of Houses Vandron and Elegion, who hold sway over Osmaru and other systems in that part of the Senex sector. They deny granting the Nebula Front safe haven. Rather, they contend that the terrorists seized Asmaru from a scant indigenous population and have been using the planet as a base of operations for raids against ships plying the Rima trade route and Corellian trade spine. Wishing to avoid becoming targets of the Nebula Front, Houses Vandron and Elegin have essentially ignored activities on Asmaru. Until now, Windu interjected. Valorum nodded. They have agreed to help us in our effort to contain the Nebula Front on Asmaru until the Eriadu Trade Summit concludes. Windu's eyebrows beetled. What help are the Senex Houses offering? Logistical support. Owing to a nearby gravitic sink, as well as to space mines sown by the Nebula Front, Asmaru is not easily approached. House Vandron has offered to guide us in. Windu considered it. You wish us to accompany the Judicial Department cruisers? Yes, Valorum said flatly. Should you consent, I will petition the Senate for authorization. But allow me to explain. This operation is not designed to be a show of force, nor an attempt at retaliation for what happened here. I propose to dispatch 2 cruisers, carrying 30 Judicials, along with as many Jedi as you see fit to include. For all we know, those responsible for the attempt on my life could be members of a radical faction. The rest may know nothing of the assassination. Nevertheless, I don't want them disrupting the Eriadu summit. I also wish to learn what they hoped to accomplish by assassinating me. If their actions sprang from not being included in the trade summit, then I want them to know that I am willing to meet with them as soon as they agree to desist in attacking Trade Federation vessels. If they are unwilling to enact a truce, the Trade Federation will likely be given consent to increase their already substantial arsenal of weapons. Windu glanced at Yoda before replying. And if our attempt to communicate these things to those in charge is rebuffed? Valorum frowned. Then I would ask that the Jedi see to it that no one involved with the Nebula Front leaves Asmaru. They are to be contained there until further notice. Windu stroked his smooth chin. You could be sending your Judicials into a trap. We have to take that risk, Valorum said sternly, then softened his voice to add, we should at least attempt to negotiate before deciding on desperate measures. He looked from Windu to Yoda and back again. Yoda stopped moving to gaze unsympathetically at Valorum.
Want to see this conflict resolved, we do.
Windu interlocked his fingers and leaned forward in his chair. The Trade Federation should not be granted additional weaponry. Defensive or otherwise, weapons are not the way to settle this. Such actions will lead only to further escalation. I agree, Valorum said sadly. And I wish it was that simple. But the Federation is deeply entrenched in Republic politics. Windu firmed his lips. We will consider what help we could lend at Asmaru. Valorum was disappointed. Thank you, Master Windu. I would also request that you consider providing security at the Eriadu summit. No one, I fear, is safe. Docking rings linked by a rigid cofferdam, the Hawkbat and a modified cloak shape orbited drab Asmaru in deep-shadowed concert. To be honest, I didn't expect you to come back. Havoc was telling Captain Cole in the forward compartment of the gunship. Cole sniffed. To be honest, I didn't expect a comeback. Havoc's partner, Sindar, made a show of glancing around the compartment. Where's your first mate, Captain? She walked, Cole said. Havoc regarded him for a moment. And you didn't walk with her? Why not? My business, Cole snapped. Sindar couldn't suppress a smug grin. You came back because you couldn't resist the credits, and she could. Cole gave his head a smart shake. It's not the credits that brought me back. It's the life. He laughed bitterly. How does someone like me retire? What do I know about farming? He slapped the blaster on his hip. This is what I know. This is who I am. Havoc swapped satisfied looks with Sindar. Then we're even more pleased to have you back aboard, Captain. Cole planted his elbows on the table. Then make it worth the trip. Havoc nodded.
Maybe you haven't heard, but Supreme Chancellor Valorum intends to press for taxation of the free trade zones. If the proposal meets with Senate approval, the Trade Federation stands to see a lot of its profits end up on Coruscant. All well and good if the Nemoidians would agree to take it on the chin, but they won't. They'll try to offset the taxes by raising the costs for shipping with them. Without anyone else to ship with, the outlying systems will have no choice but to pay whatever the Federation demands. Worlds that refuse to play by the new rules will be overlooked, and their markets will collapse.
Competition will get cutthroat, Sindar added.
Especially hard for worlds desperate to do trade with the Core. There'll be credits galore for anyone willing to take advantage of the situation. Cole gazed at the two of them and smirked.
What's all that got to do with me? I couldn't care less what happens to either side.
Havoc's gaze narrowed.
Disinterest is exactly what this job calls for, since our goal is to change the rules.
Cole waited.
We want you to assemble a team of spotters, trackers, and weapons experts, Havoc said. They have to be highly skilled, and they should share your penchant for impartiality. But I don't want to use professionals. I don't want to take the chance of their being under surveillance already, or first-choice suspects after the fact.
You're looking for assassins, Cole said.
We're not asking you to be involved in the act, Sindar said, only the delivery. In case you need to soothe your conscience any, think of the team as a shipment of weapons.
Cole's upper lip curled.
I'll let you know when my conscience needs soothing.
Who's the target?
Supreme Chancellor Valorum, Havoc said carefully. We want to strike during the trade summit on Eriadu, Sindar elaborated.
Cole stared at them in amusement.
This is the major job you promised?
Sindar spread his huge hands.
You are assured retirement, Captain.
Cole shook his head and laughed.
Who put this bright idea in your head, Havoc?
Havoc stiffened.
We're receiving help from a powerful outside agency, sympathetic to our cause.
The same one who told you about the shipment of Orodium. The less you know, the better, Sindar warned.
Cole laughed again.
Oh, secret information, huh?
Havoc's forehead wrinkled in concern.
You don't think the job can be done?
Cole shrugged. Anyone can be killed.
Then why are you hesitant?
Cole blew out his breath in scorn.
You two must take me for a furbog trader. Just because I've been chased up and down the Rima and all over this sector doesn't mean I don't keep an ear to the background noise. You tried to kill Valorum on Coruscant and you fumbled the job. Now you're turning to me, which you should have done in the first place.
We didn't fumble anything, Havoc said. We thought we could scare Valorum into inviting the Nebula Front to attend the summit. He didn't bite, so now we mean to finish the job in Eriadu.
Cole was unconvinced.
You're going to cultivate a crop of new enemies, Havoc, including the Jedi, if I know anything about anything. But I guess you're not paying me to think. Exactly, Sindar made clear. Suppose you let us worry about the backlash.
Fine with me, Cole said.
But let's talk about Eriadu. Because of what you pulled on Coruscant, security is going to be extra tight. No matter what you were trying to do, you've already undermined yourselves.
All the more reason to gather a highly skilled team, Havoc agreed.
Cole put his hands on the table. I'll need a new ship. The Hawkbat is too well known.
Done, Sindar promised. What else?
Cole considered it briefly. I don't suppose you could do anything about keeping the Jedi clear of my trajectory.
Havoc smiled. As a matter of fact, Captain, I can practically guarantee that the Jedi are going to be busy elsewhere.
Edging into jaded sunlight around the curve of a tiny moon, two diplomatic cruisers closed on pale brown Osmeru. In front and to either side of the crimson Corellian ships flew a dark escort of Tikiar fighters, resembling beaked and taloned predatory birds. Lagging behind, still in the shadow of the moon, came a pair of colossal dreadnoughts with fanged bows and elegantly finned sterns, prickly with weapons and bearing the royal crest of House Vandron. Light years distant, etched into the star-strewn backdrop, loomed an immense spiral of light, attenuating toward a center of utter blackness.
Qui-Gon regarded the crazed sky from the cockpit of the trailing cruiser. Obi-Wan stood beside him, peering between the forward seats for a better view. The female pilot and male co-pilot wore the tight-fitting blue uniforms of the Judicial Department. "Coming up on the minefield," the pilot said, while her hands were busy making adjustments to the instruments. A scattering of glinting cylinders caught Qui-Gon's eye. "I might have mistaken them for asteroids," the co-pilot said. Obi-Wan leaned toward him. "Things are not always what they appear to be." Qui-Gon shot him a disapproving glance. "Remember that when we are on the surface, Padawan," he said quietly. Obi-Wan bit back a retort and nodded. "Yes, Master." The co-pilot called up a magnified view of one of the mines. "Command detonated," he said over his shoulder to Qui-Gon. "They can probably be triggered by the terrorist sentry ships or from down below." As Qui-Gon was considering it, the female voice issued from the cockpit annunciators.
"Prominence, this is Ecliptic. Our escort advises that we raise deflector shields and hold fast to our course. Long-range scans show 3 fighter craft on the far side of the minefield. We have high confidence that they are aware of us."
Qui-Gon touched Obi-Wan on the shoulder. "It's time we rejoined the others in the salon pod." They left the cramped cockpit and walked aft down a narrow corridor that passed directly through the navigator's station, the communications station, and the crew lounge. The corridor terminated at a turbo lift, which they rode to the lower deck. Then they walked forward through the salon pod's vestibule and into the roomy pod itself. Nuzzled beneath the cruiser's abrupt bow and forward sensor array, the cone-shaped pods were interchangeable and capable of providing customized atmospheres. In emergency situations, they could be jettisoned and employed as escape vehicles. "We're negotiating the minefield," Qui-Gon said.
"Indeed we are,"
Jedi Knight Ki-Adi-Mundi said from the starboard viewport. He had a smooth, elongated skull and a piercing gaze. His chin sported a long tuft of gray hair, his upper lip dangling gray mustachios that matched his thick eyebrows.
"Worried our young Padawan appears, Qui-Gon,"
Yaddle remarked from her seat at the table.
"The minefield, is it? Or other concerns?"
Qui-Gon almost smiled. "That's his normal look of foreboding. When he's actually worried, you can see steam escaping his ears."
"I'm not worried, Masters," Obi-Wan said good-naturedly. "I'm only thinking forward."
He waited for Qui-Gon to offer some piece of wisdom regarding the living force, but for once his master kept silent.
"Right you are to think forward, Padawan," Yaddle told him. "Deal lightly with matters of consequence, and decisively with those of little consequence. Difficult it is to face a crisis and solve it gently, if not resolved beforehand you are, for uncertainty will impede your efforts. When comes the time, thinking forward allows you to deal lightly."
Her big eyes shifted to favor Qui-Gon.
"Do you agree, Qui-Gon?"
He bowed his head. "As you say, Master." Diagonally across the table from Yaddle, Sacy Tian glanced up and smiled, as if reading Qui-Gon's thoughts. Next to him, and as small in stature as Yaddle, sat Vergere, the former apprentice of Thracia Cholim, who had left the Jedi Order several years earlier. Vergere's trim torso was covered with short feathers of varied color. Her slightly concave face was slant-eyed, wide-mouthed, delicately whiskered, and bracketed by willowy ears and twin antennae. Alongside Vergere stood Depa Balaba, the hood of her brown cloak raised over her head. The voice of the Prominence's pilot crackled from the pod speakers.
"Master Tian, incoming transmission from our escort."
Qui-Gon stepped closer to the table. Shortly, the image of an aristocratic human male appeared above the holoprojector.
"Esteemed members of the Jedi Order,"
the man began,
"on behalf of Lord Kruaya and Lady Theala of House Vandron, it is our honor to welcome you to the Senex sector. We trust that you will not judge this sector by what you are likely to encounter on Asmaru. The planet once supported great cities and grand palaces, but all those fell victim to sudden climatic change. The current population is comprised of Ossan slaves, created on the Vandron world of Carfedion, but banished here owing to defects of one sort or another. Bred for agricultural work, the slaves have managed to make a life for themselves, though we doubt that you will find them especially welcoming. That might have been the case with the members of the Nebula Front as well, but for their superior weapons.
Charming, Deppa said, just loudly enough to be heard by her comrades.
We're sorry we can't be of more assistance at this time,
the human added.
Perhaps when the present crisis is resolved, the Senex houses and the Republic can meet to discuss matters of mutual concern and benefit.
The miniature figure disappeared, leaving the seven Jedi to trade looks of misgiving.
And not yet midway are we through the minefield,
Yaddle said. The comm chimed again.
Communication from Osmaru downside,
the pilot announced.
Nebula Front sentry ships are presenting no overt threat, but House Vandron fighters have dispersed to remove themselves from any possible action.
Through the port viewport, Qui-Gon could see the sleek Tikiar peeling gracefully away from the prominence. When he turned back to the table, a leathery-skinned humanoid with a barbarous twist to his mouth stood in the holoprojector's cone of blue light. His face was deeply pitted, and his features were large. His skull was shaved, save for a braided topknot that fell to his shoulders. Qui-Gon thought he was getting his first glimpse of one of Osmaru's banished slaves, until the humanoid spoke.
Republic cruisers, identify yourselves or risk being fired on.
Sacy Tian positioned himself for the holocam and spoke for the Jedi, his cowl lowered to reveal his tight, shiny face and downward-facing horns.
We are members of a diplomatic mission, dispatched by Coruscant.
This is not Republic space, Jedi. You have no authority here.
We acknowledge that, Tian replied in a calm voice. But we have prevailed upon the rulers of this sector to guide us to Osmaru for the purpose of opening negotiations with the Nebula Front.
The Nebula Front's grievances are with the Trade Federation, not Coruscant. We can settle those in our own fashion. What's more, we know full well how the Jedi negotiate.
Tian leaned toward the holocam pickup, narrowing already narrow eyes.
Then let me provide you with a reason. Coruscant has grievances with the Nebula Front when they make an attempt on the life of a Republic dignitary.
The humanoid blinked in apparent bafflement.
Your meaning escapes me, Jedi. Whose life was threatened?
The life of Supreme Chancellor Valorum.
Concern tugged at the humanoid's gross features.
Your guides have misled you. As I said, we have no issue with the Republic.
Some of the assassins were tracked to Osmaru, Tian pressed.
They may have been tracked here, but we know nothing of their actions.
Tian pressed his point.
Will you allow us to come to the surface and speak with you?
The humanoid turned to discuss the matter with someone out of view.
As a gesture of good faith, leave one of your cruisers in orbit, along with most of the judicial force,
he replied at last.
Two of our cloak shapes will usher the other cruiser down.
Tian glanced at Yaddle, then Bilaba, both of whom nodded. He swung back to the holocam pickup.
We await your escort. Is there anyone here who feels good about this?
Brigere asked while the cruiser was descending through thin clouds that barely masked Osmaru's surface. When no one responded to the delicate feathered Jedi's question, she shook her disproportionately large head.
Just as I feared.
Qui-Gon glanced meaningfully at Obi-Wan. The two of them left the pod and retraced their steps to the cockpit.
What should we do in the event of trouble, Master?
Obi-Wan asked quietly. Qui-Gon's gaze didn't leave the cockpit viewport. In a rainstorm, you try to keep dry by hurrying for shelter, but you get soaked regardless.
It's better to conclude beforehand that you're going to get wet, Obi-Wan said.
Qui-Gon nodded. The ruins of an ancient city of quarried stone appeared on the horizon. Monolithic monuments, rectangular platforms, and stepped pyramids silhouetted against the sky as if they were a range of hills.
There's the landing area, the pilot said.
She directed Qui-Gon's attention to a large plaza at the center of the ruins, as wide as the hangar arm of a Trade Federation freighter and twice as long. Bordered on all four sides by flat-faced pyramids, the plaza was large enough to accommodate a flotilla of cruisers.
Prominence, this is Ecliptic,
the same female voice said in haste over the cockpit speakers.
Our scanners have detected 5 unidentified vessels emerging from Osmaru's dark side. House Vandron's Tikiar and Dreadnoughts are leaving orbit.
Qui-Gon glanced sharply at the pilot. It's a trap, Captain. Order the Ecliptic to get clear. Ecliptic, the pilot started to say, when a long burst of static issued from the cockpit speakers. Then the female voice returned, her words shot through with alarm.
Prominence, they're detonating the mines. We can't maneuver. Unidentified ships closing. 4 starfighters and a Tempest-class gunship.
Obi-Wan shot Qui-Gon a wide-eyed look. The Hawkbat? We'll know soon enough. The prominence began to shudder violently.
We're being pulled in,
the pilot said in astonishment. She and the co-pilot struggled with the controls. Qui-Gon pressed his face to the cool, transparisteel viewport. A rectangular opening had appeared in the inclined face of one of the plaza pyramids, revealing the telltale grid of a tractor beam. It's a commercial array, Qui-Gon said. Can we break away?
We can try, the pilot said.
We could also end up blowing out the sublight drives, Obi-Wan thought to point out. The co-pilot opened a channel to the communications station. Send a burst transmission to Coruscant, alerting them to our situation. Below, the flat roof of a sprawling building was parting like a curtain, the barrel of a weapon elevated into view.
Ion cannon,
the pilot said through gritted teeth. Qui-Gon squatted down next to her. Our visit was clearly anticipated, Captain. Abruptly, she pivoted to the controls that enabled the Salon Pod ejection system.
Qui-Gon, tell your comrades to exit the Salon Pod. There may yet be a way out of this.
Qui-Gon glanced out the viewport. One of the escort cloak shapes had altered vector to move in front of the cruiser. The landing area was directly ahead, only a few kilometers distant. There are ways, Captain, but not the one you have in mind.
Do as I say, she snapped.
Qui-Gon hesitated, then leaned toward the intercom pickup. Master Tian, evacuate the Salon Pod immediately.
Why, Qui-Gon?
Obi-Wan asked. There's no time to explain. Hurry. The pilot waited for confirmation that the pod was empty. Then she triggered the pod separator charges, and the pod broke away from the fuselage. All but immune to the effects of the tractor beam because of its small size, the pod rocketed ahead of the decelerating cruiser, its self-contained jets flaring, but its course dictated by the prominence's captain. The pilot of the cloak-shaped flying point couldn't have known what hit him. Rammed forcefully in the tail by the pod, the fighter lurched forward, then veered violently to one side. The pilot tried to correct, but the repulsor lift engine had been fatally damaged, and the small craft was out of control. Belching intermittent puffs of white smoke and a stream of viscous fluids, the cloak shape tipped up onto its right stabilizer, then began a corkscrewing plummet toward the city's central plaza. The pilot leaned forward to track the fighter, her right hand clenched.
Stay on target, she urged the fighter. Stay on target.
The cloak shape slammed nose first into the sloping face of the pyramid that housed the tractor beam and flew to pieces. Narrowly missed, the grid held for a moment, then sparks began to gambol across the invisible perimeter of its deflector shield.
That's all we needed, the pilot said.
She fed full power to the tri-thrusters, was just starting her climb when the cruiser jerked to a halt, then was released, only to be jerked motionless once more.
You damaged the tractor beam, Captain, Qui-Gon said, but you didn't kill it.
The pilot's continued efforts to pull away succeeded only in throwing the cruiser into a dizzying horizontal spin. Still half in the grip of the dazed grid, the prominence slewed sharply to starboard, flying over the plaza, headed straight for the city's northernmost pyramid. Qui-Gon was certain that they were going to hit the structure head-on, but at the last moment, the cruiser surged upward. Even so, the tail struck the pyramid's upper platform, shearing off the central and starboard thrusters. At the same instant, the ion cannon opened fire. Energy pulsed from the weapon's reciprocating barrels, finding soft spots in the belly of the ship. Charges led about the deflector shield, forking like lightning, then encasing the ship in a scintillating web of blue light. All shipboard systems failed, then sporadic power returned. The cruiser commenced a rapid diagonal glide, held aloft by its sole remaining engine. Lambent with late sunlight, a large black lake expanded below. The prominence skimmed the surface of the lake, then bellied into the water and began to hydroplane toward the center. The cruiser was on a collision course with one of the rocky islands until its blunt bow dropped and the lake robbed it of forward momentum. It came to a shuddering stop in turbulent water, then listed to its damaged side and slowly began to sink. By then, the seven Jedi and the few judicials aboard had gathered at the starboard docking ring airlock. Blowing the hatch, they eased down into the frigid water and started to swim for the nearest island, which rose in a jumble of wind and water-smoothed boulders to a height of 100 or so meters. First to reach shore, Qui-Gon launched himself to dry land, landing on his feet on a narrow stretch of rocky beach. Unclipping his lightsaber, he activated the blade and swept it in front of him. Satisfied that the weapon hadn't been damaged, he switched it off and reclipped it to his broad leather belt. To the south, the sky was streaked with the contrails of ships rocketing down the planet's gravity well, no doubt headed for the landing area. Qui-Gon wondered briefly which one of them might be the Hawkbat. To both sides of Qui-Gon, Jedi and judicials were beginning to climb from the lake, their waterlogged tunics and uniforms weighing them down. Everyone was a bit stunned. With a fractured arm, the cruiser's pilot was the most seriously injured. In obvious pain, she made her way over to Qui-Gon, breathless when she reached him. "I thought we could break free," she said by way of apology. "Don't condemn your actions just yet," Qui-Gon replied. "Nothing happens by chance." The pilot nodded and looked at Sacy Tian.
"Was it House Vandron that betrayed us?"
The Itachi folded his arms across his massive chest.
"That has little bearing on our present situation."
He glanced at Yaddle.
"The question is, what do we do next?" "An immediate answer that question begs," the small Jedi replied. "As company, we're about to have."
Qui-Gon followed her gaze. Several vessels were approaching from the lake's south shore. Obi-Wan reached to unclip his lightsaber, but Qui-Gon restrained him with a look. "There's always time for that. Just now we need to assess where we stand." Obi-Wan glanced around.
"On an island, in the middle of a lake, with adversaries on the approach, Master."
"Wasn't it you who said that things are not always what they appear to be?"
Obi-Wan frowned.
"I stand corrected."
The bestial flotilla came to a hovering halt just short of the island, weapons traversing the shore. Each vessel carried a crew of humans, Weequays, Rodians, Bith, Celestans, and others, many of them layered in heavy garments, gloves, and headpieces that covered noses and mouths. Standing in the bow of the lead craft, the tall human unwound the colorful scarf that masked his lower face and cupped his hands to his mouth.
"For what it's worth, Jedi, we had planned on providing you with a warmer and certainly drier welcome."
"What are your intentions here?" the Adimundi asked.
"First, to declare that we are dismayed that the Jedi would oppose free trade in the outlying systems by choosing to side with the Trade Federation."
"We have taken no sides," Tian said gruffly. "Our sole aim is to resolve this crisis before it intensifies into open warfare. That, too, is the goal of Supreme Chancellor Valorum, who is anything but your enemy in this matter."
"We had nothing to do with the assassination attempt," someone in one of the other boats shouted.
The terrorist spokesman whirled angrily to the source of the outburst, then regained his composure.
"If Valorum is not our enemy, why was the Nebula Front excluded from the Eriadu summit?"
"If you will agree to meet with the Supreme Chancellor, he will explain his reasons."
The human shook his head.
"That's not good enough. The conference will unite the Trade Federation and the Commerce Guild against us. We demand that Valorum cancel the summit."
"Is that what this is about?" Qui-Gon asked, gesturing broadly. "You intend to hold us hostage while you issue your demands?"
The human spread his gloved hands.
"What are the chances of Valorum listening to us otherwise, Jedi?"
Tian responded.
"And should the Supreme Chancellor refuse to listen to you now?"
"Then the blood of however many of you die here will be on Valorum's hands."
Night passed slowly. Warming themselves through the Force, the Jedi huddled on the stone floor of the island's ruined summit temple, with the judicials pressed in among them. Glow sticks provided light when they needed it, and food tablets provided some sustenance. Vergere tucked her legs beneath her and sat as if roosting. Yaddle pulled her delicate robes around her and slipped easily into a trance state. Qui-Gon, Obi-Wan, Depa Balaba, Ki-Adi-Mundi, and Sacy Tian took turns at guard duty. Lifeless as the island was, The force was strong there in the lingering presence of the ancients who had assembled it. Through trapezoidal windows in the temple walls, dawn cast long red shadows into the room. When everyone was awake, Yaddle and Depibalaba got right down to business. "By now, Coruscant has learned of our predicament," Balaba said. "I'm certain that the Supreme Chancellor will not delay the Eriadu summit, but he may dispatch more judicials to Asmeru."
"A conflict that guarantees," Yaddle said. "Lost already is the ecliptic, presumably with all hands. Now additional deaths in the offing are. A better way to resolve there is."
"The Nebula Front can't hope to gain anything by holding us here," Qui-Gon said with patent suspicion. "Surely they know that we were able to communicate with Coruscant before we crashed." Vergere's willowy ears pricked up. She glanced knowingly at Qui-Gon, then cut her oblique eyes to the doorless portal that led to the temple's adjoining room. Qui-Gon listened intently for a moment, then he and Ki-Adi-Mundi stood up and moved silently to either side of the gaping opening. Yaddle, Depa, and Vergere began to converse again, as if nothing were amiss. Suddenly, Qui-Gon and Ki-Adi-Mundi reached into the doorway, tugging into the scant sunlight a humanoid, who looked as if he, or perhaps she, had risen from the ground itself. The being's thick skin was certainly impervious to wind, snow, or high-altitude solar radiation. Its four hands and bare feet were configured for digging and scooping, and its back was built for carrying loads. Eyes clearly capable of seeing in the dark were prominent in a mere suggestion of a face, lacking ears or nose, with a mouth barely suited to speech. Held in the grip of the two Jedi, the biped began to babble nervously in an unknown tongue. Depa got to her feet.
"He speaks the trader's tongue of the Senex sector houses," she said.
Yaddle nodded.
"One of their allegedly flawed bioengineered slaves, he is."
The slave continued to speak, his gaze riveted on Depa. She listened, then smiled gently and touched his shoulder.
"It seems there's an alternative we hadn't considered," she told everyone. "This one is offering to help us escape."
Qui-Gon spoke to the slave. "By what method?" Depa translated the reply.
"By taking the route he took to reach us."
The slave motioned to the adjoining room. Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan lighted two glow sticks and ducked through the doorway. In the room's rear wall, a hinged stone door, a meter thick, was ajar. The slave said something to Depa.
"This one says that this temple and the city are linked by underground tunnels. Some of the tunnels lead to the structures that surround the main plaza, the landing platform. Apparently, the plaza is lightly guarded, and this one believes that we could easily seize the starfighters parked there."
Yaddle's eyes narrowed somewhat.
"Clearly what we are meant to do," she said. "Less certain I am about our chances of leaving Asmeru."
Tien nodded decisively.
"We'll defer any decision until that option is in hand."
In single file, they moved through the hidden doorway into a cold and dank corridor. Depa continued to converse with the slave as they began to descend beneath the shallow lake.
"When the Nebula Front first arrived on Asmeru, they asked the slaves for shelter and made no demands of them," she explained. "But the later arrivals, the members this one calls the soldiers, forced the slaves to surrender their homes and provide food. The soldiers are as cruel as the Senex lords, and they frequently clash with the Front's more non-violent founders about how things should be done. Fortunately, there are few commanding soldiers on world just now."
"Few soldiers?" Qui-Gon said to Obi-Wan. "That's odd. Where are they while we are here?" The tunnel began to angle up, indicating that they had reached the mainland. Smaller tunnels branched off in all directions, and there were visible signs that the passageways were used on a regular basis for moving about the ancient city.
"We're close to the landing platform," Depa announced quietly.
The central tunnel debouched into a large rectangular cavern with stairways leading up at the center of each wall. Depa pointed to the nearest one.
"This will take us into the northern pyramid. The starfighters are parked near the structure that houses the tractor beam generator."
The slave led them up the stairs and guided them through a series of small rooms to a massive portal that looked out on the plaza. Several cloak shapes could be seen, along with the hawk bat, resting on a trio of landing pads. In the middle distance, a few armed guards traded remarks in Basic. Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan led everyone but the slave out into the plaza, most of which lay in deep morning shadow. They weren't even halfway to the closest starfighter when a voice called out,
"I'm glad to see that you've decided to join us."
Seven lightsabers igniting in a rush, the Jedi formed a protective circle with their energy blades poised for deflection. At the center of the circle, the judicials crouched with drawn blasters. The human who had spoken to them from the hover vessel the previous day stepped out onto the balcony of a palatial structure that overlooked the plaza. Then, to all sides of the plaza, appeared Nebula Front soldiers brandishing all styles of blaster weapons. Behind the terrorists gathered a curious but wary audience of slaves.
"Again we are betrayed," Ki-Adi-Mundi said.
Deppa looked back at the pyramid doorway. Quaking with primitive fear, the slave who had led them to the plaza was being shoved forward by two armed terrorists.
"Only by our predictability," she said.
"Master, who is our enemy here?" Obi-Wan asked quietly. Qui-Gon shook his head. "I've been wondering that since Dorvala, Padawan. There is more to all this than we know." The terrorist's spokesman followed an exterior stairway down into the plaza, where he was joined by a second member, a Bith. Obi-Wan glanced briefly at Qui-Gon.
"Master, isn't that..."
"Quiet, Padawan," Qui-Gon cut him off. The human and the Bith stopped while they were still some distance from the ominous circle the Jedi had formed.
"We have two choices here," the human began. "Of course, we could fight. Ultimately, you would certainly emerge the victors. But some of you might die in the process, and those who don't will be forced to kill all of us. Or," he paused briefly, "we could all lower our weapons."
Qui-Gon looked to Yaddle and Tien, who nodded curtly and deactivated their lightsabers. At a signal from the spokesman, the terrorists began to holster their blasters. Qui-Gon and the other Jedi followed suit, dousing their lightsaber blades, but keeping the hilts at ready.
"I'm delighted that we could reach an understanding," the human said in what sounded like genuine relief.
Qui-Gon's gaze roamed over the terrorists in front of him.
"Where is Captain Cole?" he asked after a moment.
The question took the human off his guard.
"Ah, of course," he replied after a moment. "You recognized his ship." "Where is he?" Qui-Gon repeated.
The human shook his head.
"I'm sorry to report that Captain Cole is no longer with us. I believe he retired. But back to matters at hand. Do we have a truce here?"
"A temporary one at best," Tien cautioned.
"One piece of business first," the terrorist said, then turned to the soldiers who had herded the slave into the plaza. Without warning, blasters discharged and the slave fell to the ground.
Deppa broke from the circle and hurried over to him. Going down on one knee as she reached him, she touched the slave's neck, then glanced up at Yaddle and gave her head a mournful shake.
"That's what happens to traitors!"
the human was shouting to the slaves who had gathered round the plaza. Qui-Gon traded brief looks with Yaddle and Tien. Seven lightsabers reignited.
"We're annulling the truce," Tien announced.
The hologram showed a diplomatic cruiser attempting to maneuver through a field of asteroid-like space mines, grazing one, then another, and another, losing pieces of itself with each encounter, and in the end vanishing in a brief-lived tempest of expanding fire.
"That was the ecliptic," Valorum explained to Senators Bail Antilles, Horrocks Rider, and Palpatine in his office in the Republic Executive Building.
Valorum switched off the holoprojector and lowered himself into his soft chair.
"Has there been further word from the Prominence?" Antilles asked.
Valorum shook his head.
"We know only that those aboard, seven Jedi and five Judicials, survived the crash. By now, they could be in captivity."
"Is there any evidence to suggest that House Vandron was involved in this?"
Senator Ryder asked.
"He was exceptionally tall, even for an Ankh, with a long bearded head that rose like a mountain spire from his curved neck. His skin was a variegated yellow-green, and his fingers were elongated spindles."
"No evidence whatever," Valorum said.
Lord Cruella maintains that the commanders of their ships were ordered beforehand to avoid engagement, no matter what occurred.
I don't accept that for a moment, Antilles said. Valorum blew out his breath.
I'm not certain that I do either.
Has the front issued any demands? Palpatine asked mildly.
Not yet, but I suspect we can sense what's coming. Demands that the Trade Federation be disbanded, or that the Republic guarantee reduced tariffs for the outlying systems. I will not consent to those, but if nothing else, we should at least postpone the trade summit until this crisis is settled.
I respectfully disagree, Palpatine said. I'm certain that is precisely what the Nebula Front wishes us to do.
Valorum's forehead furrowed. They could be holding the survivors hostage, Senator, and I'm responsible for having sent them into danger.
All the more reason to stand firm.
Palpatine glanced around the room.
Supreme Chancellor, if I may say so, the moment is ripe to demonstrate the far-reaching authority of the Republic and thus ensure Senate approval of taxation of the trade routes. Moreover, with the Nebula Front eliminated, the Trade Federation would be more inclined to accept taxation.
Valorum frowned at him. Need I remind you that the Senex sector is not Republic space? Sending additional forces to Asmeru would constitute a violation of Senex sovereignty. The Senate would never sanction such action.
Palpatine remained calm. Again, I beg to disagree. The Senate will sanction it because Republic interests are at stake.
He glanced at Antilles and Ryder.
Assuming for the moment that the Jedi have failed in their diplomatic mission, the Nebula Front is free to disrupt the Eriadu summit, and thus broaden the existing conflict to include not only the Trade Federation, but also the Commerce Guild and the Corporate Alliance. Supreme Chancellor, you yourself said that the summit should, under no circumstances, be jeopardized. That was your paramount reason for dispatching the Jedi to Asmeru.
Yes, Valorum conceded, you're right.
And what of the Senex houses? Ryder asked Palpatine.
They will support whatever actions we take, if only on the chance that we will rescind the restrictions that have prevented them from trading directly with the Republic.
Valorum considered Palpatine's remarks, then shook his head.
Even if we are successful in securing Senate approval to proceed as you suggest, a show of force at Asmeru could provoke the Nebula Front to kill their hostages.
Palpatine smiled tolerantly. Supreme Chancellor, the hostages are Jedi Knights.
Even Jedi can be killed, Antilles argued.
Then perhaps we should leave it to the Jedi High Council to decide a course of action, Palpatine suggested.
I concur, said Valorum. I will attend to the matter personally. The High Council chamber felt empty without the three masters who had accompanied Vergere, Ki-Adi-Mundi, Qui-Gon, and his Padawan to Asmeru.
Now it was Yoda who stood at the center of the inlaid mosaic floor, pacing while Mace Windu and the others discussed what was to be done.
Even without word from the prominence, we can't assume that the ship was destroyed or that any who were aboard have been killed, Windu was saying.
Everything I feel about the situation tells me that Yaddle and the others are alive.
Alive she is, Yoda said. The others too. But in grave danger they are.
That supports the Nebula Front's claim that they're holding a dozen hostages, Adi Gallia said. They're demanding that the Eriadu summit be cancelled.
Valorum must not give in to them,
Apo Ranchisus cautioned.
He isn't going to acquiesce to the demands, Windu assured everyone. He's aware that by doing so, he would only lessen the chances for ratification of the taxation proposal.
The Nebula Front is not the important concern here,
Yariol Poof said.
It is the Trade Federation that matters.
Yoda turned to the long-necked master.
Thought to be less important, the Nebula Front is. But directing this they are. Directing all of this.
He paced through a circle, then stopped.
Moving us around like pieces on a hologame board.
Then we need to finish the game, even Peel said.
Windu nodded. I assured Supreme Chancellor Valorum that there was no need for him to deliver an apology in person. We agreed to intervene in this matter. Therefore, this is as much our responsibility as it is his.
Too little thought we gave this, Yoda said pensively. Unrevealed forces at work.
He glanced at Windu.
clouded this is, muddled by motives difficult to perceive.
Windu interlocked his hands and rested his elbows on his knees. The Senate has promised the Supreme Chancellor whatever authority he needs to deal with the crisis. But we cannot leave the decision to him. Yoda nodded.
Focused on the trade summit he is.
The Judicial Department has also been given expanded authority, Windu continued. They advocate dispatching additional forces from Eriadu, which is only a jump from Masmaru's location in the Senex sector. Yoda gazed at the floor and shook his head back and forth.
Deeper and darker and murkier this becomes.
He looked up at Windu.
How many Jedi on Eriadu?
20.
Send 10 to Asmaru with the Judicials to help Master Tien and the others,
Yoda said in a troubled voice.
Pay our debts when they come due, we will.
Windu nodded somberly.
May the Force be with them, Gallia said, for everyone.
Qui-Gon, Obi-Wan, Tien, and Ki-Adi-Mundi surged from the pyramid, engaging the terrorists. A quarter of the way across the immense plaza, the Jedi spread out in a wedge formation, their constantly moving blades fending off blaster bolts loosed from ahead and to either side. Behind the energy barrier fashioned by the lightsabers, Yaddle, Deppa, Vergere, and two of the Judicials raced out to divert fire from the rear. At the point of the wedge, Qui-Gon advanced steadily into the fray, whirling and crouching, his green blade sonorous as it sent bolts arching every which way. Terrorists fell wounded from the surrounding stairways, balconies, and rooftops, but none of them fled. Unexpectedly, the unrelenting blaster fire began to taper off. Qui-Gon took a moment to look around, realizing in a rush that the terrorists were suddenly directing fire toward the heavily bulwarked perimeter of the plaza. With eerie war cries, hundreds of slaves charged into the plaza from the deep alleys separating the pyramids. Lacking anything in the way of shields, they brandished stone axes and knives, spears fashioned from the wooden handles of tools, and whatever other implements they had managed to sharpen or provide with an edge. Blaster bolts felled them by the score, but still they came, resolved to overthrow the outsiders who had robbed them of what little freedom and dignity they possessed. A second surprise gave Qui-Gon pause. Some of the terrorists were succumbing to blaster fire. It seemed improbable that the slaves had somehow managed to reconfigure blasters to suit their fingerless hands. Then he saw where the fire was coming from. Advancing in leapfrog fashion came a contingent of terrorists, led by the Bith who had been Qui-Gon's informant. Events of the day had splintered the Nebula Front into two factions, the militants responsible for the attack on Valorum, and the moderates who had for so many years restricted themselves to nonviolent actions against the Trade Federation. The militants clearly hadn't anticipated insurrection by their own confederates. All at once, the race for the grounded, cloak-shaped fighters became more desperate than ever. One of the starfighters was already lifting off on repulsor lift power. Realizing what was occurring below, the pilot wheeled the craft through a half-turn and opened up with the forward turbo lasers. Each hyphen of raw energy decimated the opposition. Stone blasted from the encompassing structures, and lightning bolt walls whizzed through the air like shrapnel, tearing into those who had managed to flee the fatal energy beams themselves. Qui-Gon understood that the one starfighter could turn the tide of battle, not only against the alliance of slaves and moderates, but also against the Jedi. Even as he was thinking it, the hovering cloak shape began to rotate toward the Jedi's side of the battle arena. The wingtip turbo lasers had swung into view, poised to fire, when without warning, the starfighter exploded and its flaming fuselage spun down into the plaza. Qui-Gon glanced up from where he had flattened himself to the ground. His eyes searched the plaza for signs of the weapon that had brought down the ship, only to grasp that the devastating bolt hadn't come from any downside emplacement. It had come from above. A crimson and white craft streaked overhead, so close that it rattled Qui-Gon's teeth. Judicial Lancet, Obi-Wan said when the sound of the starfighter's passing had roared through. White veins in the blue dome of the sky told Qui-Gon that other ships were coming down the planet's gravity well. He swung back to regard Deppa and the judicials, one of whom was speaking into his wrist comm. Sensing Qui-Gon's gaze on him, the judicial looked up and raised his left fist in a sign of confidence. Qui-Gon raised his gaze to the sky. From the south, a Corellian cruiser was on the approach. The sight of the descending fighters didn't deter the radicals from continuing their fight for the cloak shades, however. Off to Qui-Gon's left, the ion cannon pulsed. The cannon continued to send out darts of disabling fire skyward, but the alliance of slaves and moderates were already storming the emplacement. The ongoing turmoil in the plaza had prevented the cruiser from landing. While it hovered at the level of the pyramid summits, hatches opened in the underside of the ship, and 20 or more figures rappelled down on monofilament cables. Half of them were armed with blasters, and the rest with glowing lightsabers. The battle raged furiously for several more minutes. Then, hemmed in on all sides, the militants began to surrender their weapons and drop to their knees. Captives of the slaves, other groups were marched into the plaza with hands raised above their heads. Tien, Deppa Balaba, and some of the Jedi reinforcements started to meander through the devastation, gathering up weapons and tending to the wounded. Qui-Gon saw Yaddle standing at the entrance to the northern pyramid, shaking her head in dismay. He and Obi-Wan set out to find the Bith. Shortly, he saw Obi-Wan waving him over to the southwest corner of the plaza. Qui-Gon clipped his lightsaber to his belt and broke into a jog. He knew before he arrived that Calamity was waiting. The Bith was curled on his side, his long-fingered hands pressed to a blackened hole in his midsection. Qui-Gon went down on one knee beside him.
"I tried to contact you on Coruscant,"
the black-eyed alien began in a weak voice.
"But after what happened at Dorvala, Havoc and the others suspected that there was an informant among them."
"Havoc," Qui-Gon said, "is he the one who had the slaves executed?" The Bith shook his large head.
"He's just a lieutenant. Havoc is the leader. But he's not on world. Many of the militants aren't."
He paused to take a breath.
"They've undone everything we tried to do. They've turned this into a war with the Trade Federation, and now the Republic."
"It's over now," Qui-Gon said. "You've deposed them. Save your strength, friend." The Bith clamped his hand on Qui-Gon's forearm.
"It's not over. They have something dreadful planned."
"Where?" Obi-Wan asked. "When?" The Bith turned partway to him.
"I don't know. The plan was kept secret from most of us. But I know that it involves Captain Cole."
The Bith's words trailed off. Qui-Gon felt Obi-Wan's gaze on him. At the same time, all light fled the alien's eyes.
"He's dead, Master,"
Obi-Wan said. "Jedi," someone said from behind Qui-Gon. The speaker was a Nikto humanoid, flat-faced and horned. "I don't mean to intrude, but your friend was my friend as well." Qui-Gon stood up. "What do you know about this plan involving the one he called Havoc and Captain Cole?" "I know that it had something to do with Carfedion." "Carfedion?" Obi-Wan repeated. "The homeworld of House Vandron," Qui-Gon said, "deep in the Senex." He turned back to the humanoid. "Your name?"
"Sindar."
"Do you know this Havoc on sight?"
"I do."
Qui-Gon considered something, then said, "Come with us." He led the way to where Tien, Yaddle, and some of the others were gathered in the plaza.
"There's no time to sort all this out,"
Tien was saying, gesturing broadly to Ruination.
"The High Council and the Judicial Department have ordered us to leave the Senex sector as quickly as possible."
"We need to make one stop first," Qui-Gon interrupted. "At Carfedion." Tien stared at him, awaiting an explanation. "Cole is executing another plan," Qui-Gon indicated Sindar. "This one is going to help us pick up Cole's trail." Tien and Yaddle traded brief glances.
"Cole is no longer working for the front," Tien said. "We all heard as much."
"The plan has been a closely guarded secret. Someone named Havoc is behind it. We must go to Carfedion."
"Impossible, Qui-Gon,"
Yaddle said, shaking her head back and forth.
"Leave the Senex, we must."
Qui-Gon squared his shoulders. "Then my Padawan and I will go." Obi-Wan's jaw dropped slightly.
Not in any of our ships, Qui-Gon,
Tien said in challenge. Qui-Gon glanced around. Then we'll use the Hawkbat.
Making this personal, you are,
Yaddle said.
Defying a direct order from the High Council, you'll be.
Qui-Gon didn't argue the point. My duty is to the Force, Master. Yaddle studied him for a long moment.
To what end, Qui-Gon? To what end?
The hollow banner glowing through the tabac smoke in the cantina read, "The tipsy Minot welcomes the Carfedian Skull Crackers." A smashball team, the Skull Crackers were known throughout the Senex for their blatant disregard for the rules of play and for the lives of their opponents. A boisterous dozen of the local heroes were gathered in a corner of the tipsy Minot, raising flagons of fermented drink to one another and whomever happened by, growing more inebriated by the minute and fairly itching to cause trouble of a major sort. A few booths away, Cole and Boyney sat with a hulking human who might have been a member of the Skullcrackers had he been a few centimeters shorter and a lot less dangerous-looking. A pleasant-looking humanoid female, bred on one of the Carfedian slave farms, placed a tall shot of bright yellow liquid in front of Cole's guest, who downed the notoriously strong drink in one swallow. "Thanks, Captain," the human said genuinely, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. "It's not often I get a taste of the real article." Cole appraised Lope, as the man called himself, from across the table that separated them. "What's your specialty?" he asked after a moment. Lope planted his elbows on the table. "Vibroblade, stun baton, nerve pick. But I can also handle a blaster. Blastex, Mersans, Zerkas. Where have you worked?" "Up and down the Corellian trade spine, mostly. I did a stint in the Stark conflict. I'd still be in the Corps if I didn't have a price on my head for a bit of wet work I did on Sikoria." "Are you wanted anywhere else?" "Only there, Captain." Cole was encouraged. Lope was typical of the outlaws that fled to the outlying systems, but he wasn't a professional. "You'll do," Cole said. Carfedian spaceport was a sprawl of docking bays, repair shops, and cantinas even seedier than the tipsy Minot. Nodding to the several members of Docking Bay 331's maintenance crew, Cole, Boyney, and Lope closed on the battered freighter the Nebula Front had provided. "What happened to the Hawkbat, Captain?" Lope asked as he gazed uncertainly at the ship. "Too well known for where we're headed," Cole said. Cole introduced Lope to the pair of humans who were standing at the foot of the freighter's boarding ramp. "Captain," one of them said, "some dame is waiting for you in the forward compartment." "Who?" Cole said. "She wouldn't say." Cole and Boyney traded looks and climbed the ramp. "Did I tell you she would miss me?" Cole asked over his shoulder as soon as he had stepped into the forward hold. Rella was sitting in Cole's chair with her long legs crossed. "You're right," she said. "I couldn't stay away, but not for the reasons you think. Is it safe to talk in here?" Cole nodded to Boyney, who enabled the cabin's security system. "I've been hearing rumors that you're putting together a new crew," Rella said when Cole sat down. He shrugged. "What else could I do after you walked out on me?" She didn't even crack a smile. "The way I hear it, you're in the market for lookouts and second-rate exterminators, like that brute you just brought in." "Tough jobs call for tough personnel." Rella looked him in the eye. "What have you gotten yourself into, Cole? Be straight with me, for old time's sake." Cole considered it, then said, "It's an execution." She nodded knowingly. "Who's the target?" "Valorum, on Eriadu." Rella seemed to shrink in the chair, as if her worst fears had been realized. "You can't do this, Cole." He laughed shortly. "You're welcome to watch." "Listen to me," she started to say. "What, you bought yourself some scruples to go along with the new outfit? The new you?" "Scruples? Don't insult me, Cole." "Then what is it about? Valorum?" She shook her head. "It's not about Valorum. It's about you, your reputation. Without even trying, I found out that you'd been to Helsavus, Malastare, Clactor, and Yatovum. How hard do you think it's going to be for anyone else to track you? And I don't mean thugs looking to hire on with you. I'm talking about judicials or Jedi."
I appreciate the warning, Rella, but it won't matter now. I've got everything I need. Unless, of course, you want to sign aboard.
She held his gaze. I do.
All at once, Cole grew serious and reached for her hands. Listen, kid, I appreciate your finding me, but this operation isn't something you want to get involved in. She appraised him.
I don't get it. A minute ago, you were acting like you had the galaxy by the tail.
Bluster, Rella. Pure and simple.
Are you saying you wish you hadn't taken the job on?
Maybe I'm just feeling my age, but yeah. I should have stepped out of the life when I could. I mean, moisture farming can't be all that difficult to learn, right? And there'll still be exciting times.
Rella smiled broadly.
Of course there'll be exciting times, Cole. Just drop this thing. You can walk away right now.
He shook his head. I gave my word. I have to at least see this through.
Rella studied him for a moment, then forced an exhale. All the more reason for me to tag along.
If you can't look out for yourself, then I'll have to do it for you.